Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup on the Dialogue with Peter de Boer and William McGimsey. And you're listening to Reality Check Radio, and we go through the events of the past week here on the weekly roundup. And we will start once again with the international news. Although before we do that, I'm actually going to welcome you. And there's a little bit of feedback that we have had, actually two bits of feedback, negative feedback from our fans on the other side of the political aisle. And we'll get into those first. So welcome to the show, William.
Well, thanks, Dewa. It's good to join you again.
So we actually had an article written about us just over a week ago, and from Sanjana Hatatua, who was, I believe, Jacinda Ardern's, what would you call him? He was in charge of...
He was part of the disinformation project. So him and I forget the name of the other woman who was the head, but it was those two.
That's right. If people have seen the Web of Chaos documentary, and there's a clip from that that's floating around of them talking about mothers who eat healthy food and braid the hair of their blonde girls, and they go on Pinterest and they talk about being trad wives, and they're actually right-wing extremists. So everyone's seen that. Everyone's heard of that. So he's one of the guys behind this, basically. And he's written comments on how we are planning to take over the country. And that was the subject of the last weekly roundup, where we talked about is how power works and how the political change is basically done through identifying, cultivating a counter-elite and controlling bureaucracies, understanding how power structures work and trying to challenge them, work around them, and using media control to shape the public discourse and opinion. All of this stuff is basically what they've been doing for a long, long time. And we propose that, you know, what if we did it instead? And he's not very happy with that.
No. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Sanjana for writing the article on us. It indicates that we're doing something important or relevant, that we're relevant in some way. So that's a concession in a way. So thank you, Sanjana. As to what he's actually written, I think a lot of what he wrote was actually kind of true. I mean, I do think we need to cultivate our media, we need to influence people, we need to make good arguments, you need to get people in positions of power who agree with you. So all that stuff I agree with. Where I think he's been wrong and unfair is he's called us neo-Nazis, and I'll let you speak for yourself, but I mean, I'm not a neo-Nazi, I'm not a Nazi.
When you said, oh, he said some good things, I was going to say, you know, the defamatory stuff not included, right? So, And he should be a little bit careful with that as well. I think these people like to throw around these labels, and they can be very, very dangerous, and they can be, you know, they can be genuinely harmful to people. And so, you know, in terms of actually damaging their lives and their careers and so on. So I think if he's listening, he should be a little bit more careful with the kind of words that he throws around to describe people.
He increases the chance of me being randomly assaulted because people can identify me. My face is publicly available and you're calling me a Nazi, which is false. So he's engaged in stochastic terrorism against us, which is nice. Thank you, Sanjana. But I'm not a neo-Nazi. And let me just quickly explain why. I think genocide against the Jews is horribly wrong, which is rather obvious. I think totalitarian societies are bad. I support free societies. And I think starting a big war to take over the world is also a bad thing. So just to clear up all the speculation, I'm not a neo-Nazi for those reasons. I'm not sure if you want to address that accusation, do you?
I've addressed it plenty of times in the past. I won't touch it again. Get into the explaining is losing territory a little bit. I've written plenty of it on my website at rightminds.nz for anyone to read. So there's nothing really else to be said there for me.
Yeah, well, what Sanjana's modus operandi is he goes around and he talks in sort of hushed tones about people who have different political views than him, and sort of tries to conflate them with Nazism and all sorts of sinister and evil ideologies. He never makes arguments really for why they're incorrect, which is something notable. If he was really so sure that we are wrong in some way, that our views are wrong, why doesn't he just explain why we're wrong?
Well, he says that the New Zealand intelligence agencies should come and deal with us, which, you know, I've I'm happy to have lunch with the intelligence agencies, but I don't think it's going to do them any good. But certainly, I would enjoy it.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm not sure what else we can say about Sanjana than that. Thank you for writing the article, Sanjana. You can write as many articles about us as you like. Prefer it if you didn't defame us as Nazis because it's untrue. Maybe you could invite him on the program to interview him. That would be something interesting.
I will think about it. I've got a long roster of guests to get through, but you know, I might chuck out an invite or two in his direction, and we'll see if he wants to engage with us, although I think that seems unlikely at this stage. And there's also another bit of feedback. I haven't actually sent this one to you directly, but there's a guy on Twitter called Bobby who was very interested in whether or not we would be saying racist and sexist things about Kamala Harris this week. So the good news is for him that we will be talking about Kamala Harris. I'll give you an opportunity to make sure our fans get what they're after. Or I should say in this case, our detractors, of course. So international news, and I think I will start there with international news. The big change in the last 2 weeks in the US election has been the removal of Joe Biden. You could say he stepped down, but he was removed. He was shoved. And Kamala Harris is basically going to be the nominee. We've now seen her in her role as what is likely to be the nominee for over a week now. So what's your initial impression of Kamala Harris and how her campaign is going?
If the polls are to be believed, and if the talk around the polls is to be believed, things have ticked up for the Democratic presidential campaign since Biden has stepped down and Kamala Harris has stepped into the role. Kamala Harris is still very unpopular, and she hasn't really engaged in a whole lot of campaigning yet. So I think it's very early to say, but I saw some predictions from Nate Silver, who's the New York Times pollster and predictor. And he actually had Kamala Harris on track to win the popular vote, but still lose, was still like 60, well, it's like 60 something, 30 something to lose on the Electoral College because Trump still retains his appeal in those sort of Midwestern swing states where he's got the appeal to the white voters, whereas Kamala, obviously being a part black and part Jamaican, I think that's right, something like that.
Half Indian, half Jamaican,
yeah. Has an appeal to the emerging Democratic majority made up of minority groups. And so she'll likely rack up big numbers in states like California and New York and some of these places where in the Democratic blue strongholds. The thing I would say about Kamala Harris, and the thing that's funny about her, is she has this tendency when she's talking to say really obvious and self-evident things, but to say them in a way as if she thinks she's delivering nuggets of profound insight and wisdom to us. And it's really funny. There's a few clips of this circulating on Twitter where you can see her saying these types of things. I'm going to struggle to remember them off the top of my head, but there was one when she was asked about the cost of living crisis, and she says something like, "The cost of living is going up, and we need to think about that. It means people's budgets are stretched too far, and they can't cover the costs they need to cover." And then she pauses as if that's an incredible nugget of wisdom that no one had ever thought of before. And there's lots of things like that she says. So that's my initial take on Kamala Harris. She's starting from a low bar with Biden, who was senile, but he was senile, yet he sort of had that sort of grandfatherly appeal that might have actually worked in some of those Midwestern swing states. So we'll just have to see how it goes. I think Trump's still likely to win.
But Biden's appeal did work last time. And you're talking about the popular vote as well. Trump hasn't ever won the popular vote, even when he won the presidency. So that does seem very unlikely. But it's the question, like you say, of appeal in the swing states and whether or not Trump can basically pick up enough white voters in those areas. And Keith Woods, the Irish nationalist, wrote a Substack article on that just this week, very controversially saying that he believes Trump is going to lose because he believes Trump's strategy of sort of pivoting to try and appeal to minority voters is what's going to cost him the election because they're part of Kamala Harris's minority coalition, as you said. Like, she's sort of locked that in. It's ethnically predetermined, as it were. They're going to vote that way. And that really, it'll come down to having an extra percentage point or two of the disaffected rural white vote in those swing states in America that's going to determine the election.
I think that's basically right. I did catch actually that analysis that Keith wrote, and I thought it was very good because he used that, I'm not sure what it was, 8 keys or 13 keys. It's a prediction methodology developed by some professor in the States that's actually, when they've went back and applied it over many or all of the previous presidential elections, has proven to be very predictive. Like, it gets it right most of the time. And according to, and so there's a number of sort of factors that you have to weigh up, which he calls them keys or something like that. And Trump actually comes in behind when you analyze how he goes on all these different keys. So that, because that tool has been predictive in the past, I think you have to take that analysis quite seriously.
Yes, certainly. And we'll have to keep an eye on his campaign in the next few weeks and months. There's only about 90 days until the election, just a little bit less than that, I think. So it's going to be a very interesting time, and we'll keep following that on the weekly wrap-up. The other big bit of international news that I think is worth bringing forward here are the stabbings in the United Kingdom. So there were three children stabbed, three school-aged children, young girls. I think they were age 5 and 7 and perhaps a little bit older, and another half dozen wounded in Southport in the United Kingdom. And that has kicked off a number of escalating events where vigils were held, and then another man was arrested carrying a knife or a machete trying to attack more people. And this seems to have resulted in riots as well in the UK. I've seen videos now of police cars being attacked by Englishmen rioting in protest against what's escalating crime waves from effectively uncontrolled immigration and uncontrolled security, in terms of a complete lack of vetting of people who are coming in, and then complete lack of integration of people coming in. And this seems to be a situation that's been simmering in the United Kingdom for decades that looks like it's now heated up to a point that's could result at least in large-scale riots, potentially, if it's not brought under control by the government. And if they don't actually address the concerns in the long run, we'll simply see more of them.
That's right. So, I mean, I'd make two observations here. There's been a wave of stabbings, most prominently stabbings, but other sorts of violent crimes as well. But stabbings seem to be the main one, driven by immigrants, not just in the UK, but also across Europe. And this is a growing phenomenon. And the powers that be, our governments, our media, our elites, they never want to acknowledge that it's immigrants that are committing these crimes. And that's the case in this case as well. And that's my second point, is that the media has made attempts in the UK not to report on the fact that he was a Rwandan or Arab in appearance and the son of immigrants, the stabber in this case. So we have this policy of bringing in people unvetted, which is increasing the crime rate. Many of these people are involved in stabbings. And that you have to think that the anti-white rhetoric being put out by the media, by academia, by some of the politicians, is stirring up this hatred and making these violent acts by these immigrants they're bringing in more likely. So they are culpable for doing this. They're sponsoring the policy. They're enacting the policy, and the media cheering the policy, and then the media are refusing to report on the outcome of the policy, which is that the immigrants that they're bringing in are committing these horrible knife crimes. So they are creating violence with their politically correct line and with the policies they're promoting, and then they are covering up the cause of the violence and the perpetrators as well. So that, I mean, that is condemnable behavior. And the reason they give for why they're doing it is they think that if they point out the race or the immigration status of the perpetrators, that's going to be bad for social cohesion. You know, they're worried about the backlash, right? The backlash from the white majority that may occur if they were to report on the race of the immigrants. But it's the front lash, of course, that's the problem, which is the stabbings themselves. And you, media and politicians and other people, you are responsible for that front lash. And I think that you need to be held accountable for that.
And I've seen people bring up the previous cover-ups by the police, by the media, by politicians of decades of these grooming gangs from Pakistan in particular, mass rapes on an industrial scale of English girls over the space of several decades. And that was covered up. And everybody knows it happened. People in the independent media, in the new media, have reported on it extensively. Survivors have spoken out. And basically, the same situation is the media, the politicians, the police work together to bury the story because they said, oh, well, this will cause anger against Muslims or Pakistanis or whatever it might be. Like you said, it'll decrease social cohesion. But of course, what has done worse damage is the cover-up, because people find out about the cover-up. And so this continues to simmer in the background that it was covered up. So an event like this happens, a mass stabbing, three young girls killed, and everybody thinks back to all the previous events that were covered up that didn't result in any policy change, that didn't result in any acknowledgement from the media, from the police, from the politicians as to what they did wrong. And that is the most dangerous thing in the UK at the moment, is the fact that those three groups in particular, media, police, and politicians, have worked together to make sure that these problems are not fixed. And the people at some point will demand one way or another to have these problems fixed, and things can get very, very ugly. And then it will be too late to stop them, because every chance to solve the problem in a peaceful way will have been denied by the coalition of media, police, and politicians.
Yeah, and where does it end? What's the end game of this? It's just sort of increasing rates of violence and increasing rates of demonizing the victims who complain about the violence. How is that sustainable?
Well, somehow they believe they're going to progress in some way, or they'll give out enough money, or they'll do enough lectures on how people ought to behave, and that somehow will fix things. This utopian idealism where they think if they just cover it up enough that eventually everyone will become more liberal and more tolerant over time. We've seen the complete opposite. I don't know why they still hold to this. Even after this event here, they're still going to hold to that completely insane idea that's contrary to everything that we know to be true about the human condition. And they will continue down the road to disaster. Like, they have no way to admit their failings. Very, very sad to see, and very, very dangerous to see.
Yeah, I mean, their political views are part of their identity, or their self-conception of their identity. And so they cannot admit they're wrong or change their mind without, in their own view, giving up a part of themselves, giving up an important part of how they view themselves. So they're so dug in on this stuff, it makes it very difficult. I mean, I'm reminded of that. I can't remember the name of the woman online who talks about the trans parents, right? The parents who have trans their kids. She says those people are going to be like the Japanese soldiers, you know, on these islands who've never heard the war event, because they can't psychologically bring themselves to recognize what they've really done to their children by transing them. And the people who are dug in on this immigration and multiculturalism and diversity thing, they're in a kind of a similar boat. It's going to be very hard when you look at the horrible things that are resulting from your policy. It's very hard to look that in the face and acknowledge that you and your way of thinking and the policies that you've enacted are responsible for that, and own up and change your mind. And so we're stuck in this situation where they deny, they stick their heads in the sand, and they blame the other guys who point out the problem.
Now, since you have raised the trans issue, we will move away from international issues and head more to a local one, because the UK has banned puberty blockers for a while now, and the new government has upheld it. The Supreme Court there has upheld it. So puberty blockers are banned there in the UK. And yet in New Zealand, we see the opposite. Almost. We have new gender ideology guidelines from Health New Zealand. We see other cultural changes they're enforcing. I think they were in the news as well this week about the karakias, pagan prayers that they were enforcing in the workplace. Why are we heading in the wrong direction on this particular issue when this is the one that the UK seems to at least be dealing with head on at the moment? And yet we're rapidly deteriorating, even with our supposed right-wing government.
I can't answer why. Perhaps it's got something to do with Matt Doocy, who's the Minister of Mental Health, who may have some responsibility for these portfolios. But even then, I'm speculating. But in the UK, I think we have to take the win there. So the court ruled in favour of the UK government's ban on gender affirming care, or what it's called, like transing the kids, basically. And that's a good thing, because often what we see in sort of in cases like this is this idea where the government passes a law, but then it's undone because somehow it's contrary to someone's conception of human rights law or something like that. And that could easily have happened here. You could have had activist judges overturning it, but it didn't happen. So I think we should be very grateful that it hasn't. And when we turn to New Zealand, what's happened here? In recent days, we've had revelations that Health New Zealand has issued new guidelines on a new sort of gender diversity policy that explicitly says that it's not just women who can menstruate. All sorts of different people can menstruate, including many men. And so this is just silliness, right? Yeah. I mean, it's hard to take it seriously, but it is serious. They really put that out there. It's bad. You know, it's really bad. We have the CAS report now. We have a lot of the other material that's come out of the UK and these other places that says this, that we have the WPATH files, that this, the gender-affirming care, the trans health care for kids who are confused about their gender is really, really bad. You're castrating them. You're sterilizing them. You can prevent them ever having kids. They have all these problems later in life. The lack of bone density, early onset arthritis. They develop mental problems at higher rates. And the surgical interventions are just horrific. Jordan Peterson was on the, I saw a clip of Jordan Peterson the other day saying the surgical interventions that they're doing to trans people, to change them into the different gender, worse than the things that happened in the camps in Germany, worse than the things that the Dr. Mengele and people like that were doing. And I've looked at some of the graphic pictures and I've read some of the WPATH files, and it is really, really bad, really, really sick stuff. And we have to ask, what more information does the New Zealand government and the New Zealand health bureaucrats need to update their guidance and the way they're treating this within New Zealand? If that information isn't enough, what information would do it? What information do you need about the horrific things that are happening to these trans kids?
You mentioned Matt Ducey, the associate health minister who was involved with the Tavistock Clinic in the UK, which basically kicked off a lot of the reports and the studies that exposed just exactly the horrific nature of a lot of this so-called trans-affirming care for children, sterilizing the kids and mutilating them. I think that is having an impact on the New Zealand government, unfortunately. But of course, the bureaucrats that we have need to be cleaned out. And that's a real problem that the current government has. They haven't cleaned out these bureaucrats who are putting out these papers, who are putting these together. And these are probably the same bureaucrats behind, as you know, I mentioned just before, the Karakia mandatory pagan prayers and so on. All of these, this strange, very strange cultural enforcement that it seems to just be people who are almost faceless workers in the bureaucracy who think they can get away with all of this. And they can get away with it unless the government does something and just pushes them out. And there has to be a proper purge of Health New Zealand from just all of this crazy insanity, the genuinely evil people who are there, who are putting this stuff out, who need to go. That's the only solution for the problems that we have with, within the Ministry of Health.
Yeah, but the problem is I'm seeing this in a number of areas. And the stuff that we were seeing that the Labour government was doing that drove a lot of people to vote them out is sort of creeping back in now in a number of areas. So obviously we've got this trans healthcare stuff where they were supposed to update their guidance back in, I don't know, February or early this year, and that we still haven't seen that policy update. We've got the...
It's the first thing that I'm failing them on in terms of policy commitment tracker, because they're not doing anything. It was supposed to be urgent. Urgent. I mean, what, 6 months, no, 8 months, 9 months later, it'll be a year later, they won't have done anything for sure. Yeah, it's just a total failure by this government.
Yeah, then we had the revelations about the Sport New Zealand report into preventing trans people from competing in the women's sport division. And that there was some sort of ambiguity there about whether they were really banning them or not. So that wasn't very good. And what else? We've got the Law Commission doing work now on sneaking protections for trans people into the Human Rights Act that could end up in hate speech laws again when we've had the promise from the government that they're not going to enact any more hate speech laws. So I'm not sure why the kibosh isn't going to be put on that piece of work.
Right, because the government can just tell them to stop, right? That's how this works. The government just says, stop doing that work, and it stops.
The government is, well, they did do that with respect to the hate speech laws that they were working on in another area. But they've sort of come back in this trans area. So they are capable of telling them to stop. And actually, the elected officials are actually in charge of the public service, nominally. They ought to, on paper, at least have the ability to tell these people to pull their heads in and get with the program. But it doesn't appear to be happening. And so I'm not on the inside. I can't tell why that's happening. But I wish the elected representatives there would
released early on in the government. The new government, we had several ministers basically publicly release letters to their ministries and how they expected them to behave. We had one to the New Zealand Police, one to the New Zealand Transport Agency. And you had the ministers in charge of those areas who laid out exactly what they expected to happen. And for the most part, as far as I can tell, that seems to sort of have happened. With the exception of the police, we found, although maybe things have changed because the reports that we have had in the past week from police that they're also doing sort of hate crime, hate speech training. They're teaching the police on how to spot hate crimes, hate speech, when, you know, obviously there's no such offense in New Zealand. There's no such crime. And the training that's been released, perhaps you can tell us a little bit about what exactly the police are teaching is being hate speech. Probably about 90% of the things that we talk about on this show as examples.
The two examples that I've read, and this put out in a letter by the Free Speech Union, are of extremism, and you'll love this, is that people, and one example is people who say there are only two genders, for example. And another example they had was, you remember the old national campaign billboard where it had iwi, not kiwi, or kiwi, not iwi, sorry?
Yeah.
That was another example of hate speech and radical extremism. So this idea of police hate speech training has come out of the recommendations from the report into the Christchurch terrorist attack, right? Mm-hmm. And it was on the basis of that report that Jacinda Ardern tried to push through her hate speech laws, which got shot down. And then she tried to sneak the hate speech laws in through the back door with like the campaign against myths and disinformation. And with that, I think we've kind of gotten on top of that one too. And that's
as far as I can tell, seems to have been mostly shelved. But of course, she still has her own Christchurch call agency, where she's got a lot of a mandate from multinational corporations and NGOs to kind of keep pushing that at a global level.
Yeah, but it's like this stuff, you know, we don't have hate speech laws, but they keep trying to put it in. Like, it's like playing whack-a-mole. You whack it down here and it pops up over here in the Law Commission. You whack it down there, it pops up over here in this other government department. It's missile disinformation. You know, they're determined. They're going to try and bring it in somehow, whether the law allows them to, whether any elected representatives give them the power to do it. They just seem determined to try and bring these things in. And I find it unacceptable. The public don't want it. All it is what they're deeming hateful is just other people's views, other people's political views or religious views or moral views. And they're saying, well, you can't have that. That's hate. Why? It could just as easily be hate the other way around.
Yeah. Almost every example, I don't want to say every example, because I think they did have maybe one or two things that you could say are genuinely nasty, but even then nasty, not hate speech or hate crimes, but almost every example in the police training manual there was normal opinions that normal people have that are just in disagreement with the liberal progressive plan for the country. And
it's part of the plan to marginalize the normal and normalize the marginal.
It's by taking the center and pushing it out to the margins and saying, are these the things that everyone believed and until yesterday, and maybe half of the people in the country or 70% of the people in the country still believe today, that stuff has got to go. That stuff's hate speech. And they're preempting that to push it out, right? They want to keep pushing the normal things out to the margins, and the police are just putting it in there as a way to silence people and say, Okay, the police are saying this is this is hateful. I don't want to get offside with the police. I don't want to get in trouble with the police. I better not say these things. And it's just intimidation, political intimidation.
Yeah, at a certain point, it has to be challengeable through the courts or through some. There has to be some avenue to challenge this, because you can't have the police treating things that aren't even laws as if they are laws and enforcing them. That's just completely arbitrary. And
it doesn't seem like they're going to be enforcing this per se, but they're trying to train the police officers to think about things in this way and then to document them in this way so that they can then use them against people later. So they can then say, oh, yes, we had a complaint from such and such a person who said there are only two genders online. Oh, we can now, when they run into you in some other way, we're like, whether it's firearms licensing or they're, vetting maybe for the police or intel or, a government agency where you may be access to classified materials and something like that. Oh, we have these red flags against this person in our database because they said there are only two genders, or because they said that they're pro-life and whatever else that they put in these documents. They can then create this profile against people and try to exclude them from the power structures. That's probably more what's being done there. They're trying to mount a defense of the bureaucracies that they control and try and find shibboleths, as it were, the shibboleths they can then keep the people out that they don't want, which is the normal people, the people who would be able to turn things around. Right at the beginning of the roundup, we were talking about a plan to take back the institutions and to shift the balance of power. And it's like you see these documents that are in these agencies that are being leaked out, and it's like they're actively trying to prevent this from happening. They're actively trying to prevent the right people from taking back what was ours.
Yeah, and it's in line with the trend we've seen in other countries like the UK, where the police are increasingly focusing on policing the words and the speech of people, particularly online, but also in other areas, rather than focusing on real crime. And there's a word for that, and it's anarcho-tyranny, right? Where you focus on policing the law-abiding people really hard, but you don't worry about the less law-abiding people because it's too difficult. Like the police don't want to get caught up in people who are really willing to fight back and come after them with machetes or something like that. You might get hurt doing that, but if you just go around to the law-abiding people's houses and warn them about some of the stuff they're saying on the internet, they know that that's really safe, so there's no problem. The example, actually, just going back, the example that I heard Jonathan Ayling giving, I think he was doing an interview on a different media outlet. He said one example was someone yelled a pro-Palestine thing out of the window of a car, and the police got the woman. So they identified it as hate speech, but then they got her on disorderly conduct, right? So there's enough crimes on the books that like that you can identify hate speech and then find another crime to charge people with. And that's really the issue here. It biases the way the law enforcement works.
Well, it's a Stalinist approach to law enforcement, right? Show me the man and I'll show you the crime.
Selectively going after people based on their political views.
Another report that was released by the government in the past week was just over a week now, I think, but we didn't have a roundup last week, was a report into the abuse in state care, which was a very tragic, very sad report, estimating that at the very least tens of thousands, at the most 100,000, 200,000 children may have been abused in some way or neglected in some way in state care. And this report, I think, looking at this report and looking at the issues that we've just been discussing, particularly on what Health New Zealand is doing with still pushing gender ideology, you see an apology from the government, and it feels very, very hollow in that, okay, they've said, okay, we're sorry for this abuse that took place. And yet, as far as I can see, they're still perpetuating abuse on a completely different scale now and justifying it. In a few years' time, who knows, you may have Luxon's successor apologizing for the next abuse that has taken place here in New Zealand. Do you see any real change happening in the government where these problems that have been identified in state care are going to be dealt with? Or perhaps you know, the thing that they've investigated has been dealt with, and we're simply moving on to the next thing, and that they're not paying attention to.
Well, I mean, maybe I sound pessimistic a lot of the time I'm on here, but I am optimistic, and I do think people and societies do have the capacity to learn. And I think that we will learn from this abuse and care report, which I think the abuse documented in there is tragic and horrible, and it's completely appropriate that the government apologizes for it and tries to make amends for it. And I think that we will, as a country and as a government, take steps to recognise the harm that's done and to reform the institutions, much of which has probably already happened, to ensure that things like this don't happen again. But you're completely right in pointing out the irony that while we're issuing a state apology for this terrible abuse that happened over here, the politicians and the bureaucrats can't seem to figure out that we're committing this other abuse over here with the trans healthcare, the gender affirming healthcare for children, that we're probably likely going to have to apologise for in however many years down the road when they figure out that it's a human rights catastrophe.
And is there, I guess, a part of, did the government step in too much in the past? I think the state care apology was from the 1950 to today, basically 70 years. Was there a big change in how the state intervened in people's lives that was taking place in terms of taking children away from families? Or was the government really doing the right thing, at least in intervening in those situations where they thought, you know, children had to be uplifted, had to be removed from families and so on? And because that seems to still be a very contentious issue in New Zealand, in particular with Oranga Tamariki sort of complaints from Maori about bias against them, and also clashes in parliament between some MPs on basically, you know, should cultural preferences be taken into account when children are uplifted, or is the government overstepping its bounds still, or has it been doing that in the past? Or do you believe that its level of intervention has sort of been appropriate, but just the way that it's been handled has been terrible?
Getting a wee bit outside my area of expertise here, I don't think I could comment on that really. What I would say about the cultural preferences, though, for example, I agree with that with Karen Shaw that it's the safety and the well-being of the child and the family they're put into that's more important rather than the cultural background. But I would say that the cultural background, although it's a secondary issue, still has some importance. I think there is reason to believe that the different people, like the genetic differences between people, mean that the types of cultural environment they're raised in, some types of cultural environment may be more or less suitable for them. People aren't all the same, is what I'm trying to say. And being raised in an environment that conforms to your culture, I think, is probably a good thing. And there is probably evidence to suggest that that is the case.
I guess what I was getting at more was sort of the change in centralization of state power and people being, you know, moving away from their traditional bonds, and especially, I guess, urbanization. A lot of that would have been happening in the first half of the 20th century, which sort of led to the breakdown of family. A lot of government policies led to the breakdown of family, and that resulted in the state over intervening in uplifting children and breaking apart families, you know, because of the policies that it had already enacted to disconnect people from their traditional backgrounds, and it had already begun the path really to break down the family, especially, you know, from the 50s, 60s, 70s onward. A lot of the progressive policies really started to take hold. And I don't think there's much introspection there from the progressives as to the effects that their policies have had. And a lot of the cultural stuff that you see now in government departments, some of which we've discussed earlier on the show already, is just window dressings, just, you know, pay lip service to the cultural traditional issues, the breakdown of tradition, the breakdown of family, and think, oh, if you just put up a few stickers and say a few words and fly a flag here and there, that somehow that need has been dealt with. And really what the government has been presiding over is a complete breakdown of traditional family structures, and you know, what the answer really is a return to a more conservative way of life. And that's something that the government is not addressing at all. And it doesn't seem like a change in government, left wing or right wing, is going to make a difference to that.
No, I agree with what you're saying there. I mean, there has been a breakdown in family formation. I think if you go back to probably the 1950s, 1960s, you'll see a general trend of increasing divorce rates, increasing numbers of children born out of wedlock, increasing family breakdown, and that will all contribute to, you know, children being taken out and put into state care, I imagine. On the other hand, we do have a higher material standard of living now, and that can allow single women, with the help of welfare benefits, which is not ideal, I'm not condoning it, but it does help them in the care of children somewhat, where in the past, that extra material support for their standard of living might not have been available, and made things worse and made the need to transfer them to a new home higher. So I'm sorry if that's a bit ambivalent.
No, it's similar to what I was saying in terms of some band-aids being applied to, you know, without dealing with the actual root of the problem. And so it's, yeah, something for us to keep talking about, keep raising awareness for, keep working on, and in terms of real political change in these areas that are actually dealing with the root causes. And one last political issue for New Zealand before we move back to a final two international issues, just very quickly, since we have about 10 minutes left, I think. The Green Party in Parliament has not had a good week as well. They've had the Polynesian leaders resign at their recent conference, largely over the treatment of the women of colour in the Green Party caucus, they claim, sort of a infighting in the Greens, where the Greens aren't woke enough. The Greens are accusing each other of being racist and so on. But they have had some real problems with these candidates, these MPs, and it seems like that has created real fractures within the Green Party. Do you see this impacting their level of support? Do you see them actually breaking apart into separate factions completely? Or is it likely that people like Tama, like the Polynesian leaders, that they sort of go to the other factions on the left, right? They go to the Maori Party, they go to the Labour Party, depending on the Greens not really delivering on their particular ethnic issues, and that the Greens are sort of trying to refocus themselves on this kind of urban liberal, sort of wealthier liberals who care about the environment, and they're kind of shedding off some of the more contentious racial issues that seem to be plaguing them.
I think that is a possibility, yeah. We've seen the Maori Party make some tentative overtures towards trying to attract Darlene Tana, which is interesting. And we've seen, as you said, the Polynesian caucus resigning. There does seem to be some sort of problems in the Greens with managing the racial divides. And I think part of that is really just once you sort of, it becomes a downward spiral once you get into this sort of racial sensitivity. There's no bottom to how sensitive you can be to these racial issues. And if you really take that idea of being racially sensitive on board, you're going to be offended by everything all the time, and none of your different racial groups are going to be able to get on. And that seems to be what is happening in the Greens. If you look at the things they're complaining about in that letter, they're complaining about the treatment of Darlene Tana and Elizabeth Kerikeri, who were, I mean, I think that there's good reasons to get rid of those people. they were doing things wrong, but yet that's the Polynesian leadership group seem to either not accept that, or they kind of accept it but still think that there's some sort of racist element to it as well at the same time. And the other element there was unhappiness with the Pacific leaders being ignored around the time of Ephesa Collins' death. And I mean, I really can't comment too much on what that was to do with, because I wasn't there and I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I just think this too much sensitivity to racial slights has the inevitable consequence of you're not going to be able to get along, because you're going to find these racial slights everywhere, sometimes even where they're not intended.
It's something that I took away from their letter, was them sort of saying, you know, equal sort of giving people equal treatment or giving going through these processes isn't fair to ethnic minorities, because equal treatment basically benefits the ethnic majority, and so they needed to be treated in a different way because they were ethnic minorities, and that seemed to me like the ultimate race to the bottom, basically, where, you know, at the point at which you're arguing that a due process, a fair process, that everyone gets the same process, and you're arguing that that's going to disadvantage your ethnic minority, at that point you've completely lost the plot in terms of trying to get along with anyone else. You can't go and demand you should be treated differently when it comes to disciplinary process.
Yeah, it's going to be very difficult, isn't it? Like, that's if you have a different if you have different standards for misbehavior within the party based on what race you are, I don't know how well that's going to be.
So, well, I mean, that's how I read their demands. So good luck to them wherever they go, because I don't think anybody wants to have to deal with that. Even the most sensitive liberals are not going to want to have to deal with that.
Well, no, it would take up all your time, if nothing else. All your time managing that, you can't do your normal politics work.
Now, we'll get back to two more international issues here, which I think are difficult to comment on, so I've left them right until the end, because we don't really know what's going on. But they're worth mentioning for the listeners, just so that they're aware. Venezuela had an election, and the outcome of the election was that the incumbent president, Maduro, won. But there was an exit poll released before the votes were all counted that said he was going to lose, and so the opposition has claimed fraud. You know, this being Venezuela, that doesn't seem unlikely that there could be fraud, but there seem to be two very competing factions based on international allegiance in Venezuela. You have the Maduro government, it's aligned more so with the Eastern bloc, and it seems like his opposition was aligned with the Western bloc. And it seems to be very heavily influencing the view that people take on this. But interested to hear what you think, because we tend to take a bit more of an agnostic view on East-West conflicts. So, you know, I'm happy to get your two cents on the Venezuelan election.
Well, in remaining consistent with previous things, we're going to remain agnostic on this too. So there's dueling competing narratives, right? The pro-Maduro narrative is that he won the election, and the US government and other international forces are stirring up these lies about the election being rigged in order to agitate the population to overthrow him and install a different government. So that's the pro-Maduro narrative. And we've had WikiLeaks weigh in kind of on that side, which is interesting, saying that the exit poll that you mentioned was done by a company linked to US intelligence agencies. It was also used in Ukraine and maybe some other country where they had a regime change, which is interesting. Maduro himself gave a speech where he said, and this is really interesting, he gave a speech where he said, oh, well, look, this is the same thing that happened to Kennedy. Like, they assassinated Kennedy because he wanted to stop the Vietnam War. The CIA is doing these regime change things all around the world, and they're coming after me because, you know, I'm a socialist. I'm using the oil money to help my own people. They've put all these sanctions against me. They hate me. They want regime change. So that's the Maduro narrative. And the other narrative is that Maduro is a dictator, socialist dictator. He's run his country into the ground, and he's rigged the election to stay in power. And we ought to try and, because he's rigged the election, we ought to try and get him out of there. So it's very, you know, it's fog of war stuff. You obviously have these two factions competing, one wanting Maduro to be in, one wanting to get him out. I can't tell where the truth is in that. It's about power, isn't it? It's about power. And when things are about power and where the truth lies, it's often very hard to tell.
Yeah, that's right. I would hope to think that if there were a victory by his opponents, if the opposition were to take power, you'd see sort of a westernization, I guess, in Venezuela. You would see policies enacted that would increase their standard of living, they would increase their freedoms and so on. They would get rid of this dictator. I can see the appeal in that, you know, whatever the outcome of the election was. And yeah, I also am a little bit sympathetic to the argument of that it being a color revolution. We've talked about color revolutions in, on the show before, the CIA overthrowing governments around the world and putting in friendly governments to the United States. But if you're pro-United States, then, of course, hey, having another government in the world that's pro the United States, that's good for you. So it's something we'll keep an eye on. We'll comment on it if there is anything else to comment on. But it's a very volatile situation at the moment. And as a listener, you may decide which side of the fence you fall on here, since it has no real direct relation on New Zealand, in my opinion.
Yeah, you don't have to take sides if you don't want to.
No, that's right. we can simply study, we can comment on, and like in this case, it's very easy for us to bring you both sides of the story because it's, like you said, we don't really know what's going on for sure. And another international story that's perhaps less ambiguous, but there have been a number of escalations in the Middle East. This week, Israel struck both Lebanon and Iran, so a Hamas leader in Iran and a Hezbollah leader in Lebanon were killed. And this is largely in retaliation for a strike that was committed on Israel, where the Hezbollah hit a soccer field, I believe, and they killed 12 children, injured dozens of others. It's a very terrible situation. And it looks like Israel has tried to respond with some force, but also with the permission of the United States government as well. So they haven't gone out and committed anything at a very large scale. Seems to be surgical strikes on leaders. Do we see an escalation, in your opinion? Do we see the situation stabilizing? And perhaps even after his visit to the United States, is Benjamin Netanyahu trying to kind of wrap things up, as it were? Like, he's not really sure. He may only have 3 months until the election. Kamala Harris doesn't seem very friendly towards his interests. Donald Trump has also signaled that he wants things wrapped up, as he says, and he wants Israel to win, but he wants them to wrap it up fast. Yeah. On the whole, do you have any other insights into that part of the world and any predictions to make for what's gone on there in the last week?
I will say that these seem to be quite bold actions, surgical, but still bold, to commit airstrikes inside two other countries. In Lebanon, on Beirut, where they killed the Hezbollah, a senior Hezbollah figure. And then in the Iranian capital as well, an airstrike within the Iranian capital to kill a leader of Hamas who was there. I think he was there for the, is it the president's inauguration in Iran, or the new prime minister? I forget the name of the figure, but he was recently killed and replaced by someone else. So yeah, very bold. Whenever you're committing military actions on someone else's territory, that's a significant event.
Especially two capitals of two foreign nations as well.
Yeah, it does invite the possibility of retaliation. We should expect that there will be some form of retaliation. It's a matter of kind of honor or saving face for these nations, that when there's an attack on their territory like that, they have to be seen at least to respond in some way. And so I think that will happen. And there is a serious risk of regional escalation here. Maybe that will happen, maybe it won't. But I don't have any particular view apart from a general worry and concern that it will escalate.
We had this last time. I think a lot of people talk big about the previous attack on Iranian territory and the Iranian response, where they threw back hundreds of drones and several missiles, and they did hit one or two targets in Israel, no major damage. But I saw that as kind of a positive when it was all done and dusted, and thought, you know, they've saved face and they haven't gone to war and
got it out of their system.
yeah, exactly. So they're trading blows, but both keeping it as minimal as they can to kind of try and achieve their objectives. Like, nobody, it doesn't seem like they really want to go to war, even though you see all these people online and all these commentators like, yeah, there's going to be the big next war. To me, as an outsider, someone who doesn't have a real stake, doesn't care that much about the outcome, I just don't see the desire from either side to really go to a full-scale war. It looks like Israel wants to finish up its revenge against Hamas, basically, and Israel will continue to have its revenge on Hamas, whatever it takes. And and you know, it has to manage its domestic situation as well, which is can be quite fragile within Israel. The politics of this are definitely not a one-sided thing. In fact, this week, I don't know if you saw, they had several allegations of torture. Israeli soldiers were accused of torturing Palestinian prisoners, and this seemed to be very serious and basically guaranteed to be true, in the sense they made arrests and they were fairly sure they would be convicted of war crimes. At least the Israeli paper I was reading said that. So, and this has led to protests within Israel, on pro-army protesters being upset that soldiers are being arrested for torture, which seems a bit weird. And of course, on the other side in Israel as well, of course, you can see anti-government protests as well, that soldiers have been torturing civilians. So things could get ugly domestic and in the domestic side for Israel as well.
Yeah, I mean, I heard it described as Israel's own Abu Ghraib. I think it's still too early to decide how serious it is, but it sounds pretty bad. Now, the other factor to consider here is how these military activities affect the domestic popularity of Benjamin Netanyahu and his government. The last I heard, his popularity had fallen since the start of the war, so that's the other factor that weigh into.
People often don't take that into account when they're making commentary about the war between two different countries, in this case Israel and Hamas and Gaza, is that, yeah, domestic popularity actually has to play a very big role, and something to keep a very close eye on. Well, that's really it from me and for the weekly roundup. We're just over time now, but that's fine. I'll wrap up the show after this. So thank you again for joining me, William, and it's a pleasure to have you on as always.
Thanks, Dara. Pleasure to be on.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.